This Dharma Talk, Staying on Our Own Side by Mare Chapman, was recorded at the Women's Retreat on December 14, 2018 at Holy Wisdom Monastery in Madison, Wisconsin.
All right, here we go. We all want to be happy, safe, and secure. We all want to be loving and joyful. We all want to be authentic and relax with ourselves. We want to be helpful and make good use of this precious life. We want to know we are enough. We want to trust that we'll be able to handle whatever arises in life with a steadiness of unshakable confidence, right? Yet in these tumultuous times, really it's hard to stay anchored in confidence and trust, or to know what we can do that would actually be helpful. You know, we all know we're bombarded daily with news of more disintegration of what we hold dear. Racial, religious, ethnic, class, and gender equality are all on the line. It's so easy to get swept up in fear and anger and despair and join the chorus of wailing voices crying, "What happened to our values of equality, respect, decency, and care for the welfare of all?" These painful feelings can propel us into tribal polarities that are gripping our world. It's also tempting to convince ourselves that my loved ones and I will somehow escape the effects of all of this. But in that delusion, we forget the reality that everything is interconnected. Interdependence is a law of nature. Everything is interconnected. Nothing truly exists in isolation or as a separate entity ever. Each of us is part of the web of life. We're affected by everyone else, and in turn, affect everyone else. There's no escaping the truth that every single one of us actually matters. So whatever mind state we're in, whether we're aware of it or not, makes an impression on others. And the mind states of others affect us. Our own equanimity, or lack of it, is continuously shaped by both our inner and outer world. And given this truth, in the current state of conditions where, as the Buddhist teachings say, the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion appear to be ruling, threatening to overpower the values we hold dearest, it's clearly the time to become fully empowered spiritual warriors. It's time to deepen our connection with our wise and loving hearts so we can take skillful action to do whatever we can do that's within reach. This is a time of profound change in our culture, and we don't know what will evolve. So instead of contracting out of fear or slamming our hearts shut to those who hold opposing views and appear so different, it's time for all of us to do our own inner freedom work. We are all subject to delusion, hatred, and greed. Through no fault of our own, we develop distorted views of ourself and others. So this is a call for all of us to take 100% responsibility for the habits and behaviors that make us feel estranged and afraid of each other. Now is the time to heal our hearts and minds so we can grow in our ability to live in harmony with each other, respecting our differences without fear. To do so, we must tend first and foremost to our relationship with ourself. Because we're interconnected, this is not selfish. It's self-responsible. It's the most fundamental way we can each contribute to creating the changes that will help our world through this crisis. And this is where we each have leverage, our personal power to constructively affect ourselves and in turn affect others. My very first spiritual teacher, Dahani Wahu, a Native American Buddhist Rinpoche and leader of the Summary Meditation Society, said, "We each have a spiritual responsibility to learn how to create our own happiness. This is the single most important way we can each contribute to the planetary peace." So if we want our world to be inclusive, accepting, loving, and respectful of all, we must learn to truly accept, love, and respect ourselves. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, "Your capacity for loving another depends on your capacity for loving yourself." So our relationship with ourselves is the most important relationship in our life. It forms the foundation for every other relationship. And since we've been living with ourselves every second of our life, we know more about ourselves than anyone else is ever going to know. Not that we all don't have our blind spots, and our growing edges, because we do. But it is ourself, more than any other person, who can truly understand and get us. And even though we're interconnected and dependent on others in so many ways, we also know that we can never totally rely on others, even our dearest and our closest, to always understand, support, and accept us. Everyone has their issues, their limits, and times when they're simply not available. So we're wise to become the primary support person for ourselves. We're the only one that can truly know what's true for us. We're the only one who has access to our own wisdom. The Buddha reminded us of this truth in his parting words before he died. He said, "Be a lamp unto yourself." So we must learn how to be the one that we can always rely on. And to me, this is what the practice does, and it's one of the most profound gifts of mindfulness. It trains our mind to become our friend instead of our enemy. It's truly a way of getting to know ourselves. It teaches us to accept, love, and relax with ourselves. I mean, in so many ways, mindfulness is the study of the self and our relationship to ourself. And by understanding that whatever we're experiencing in the present moment is always valid and worthy of our attention, and by learning to relate to our authentic experience skillfully over time, we naturally cultivate a deep, trusting relationship with ourselves. And the more we can trust our authentic self, the more we have access to our wisdom, our unique gifts, our kind heart, our joy, and all that we are. By accepting our authentic experience of the moment, we create the inner conditions where we can stay steady in these difficult times, and through that steadiness, be of most benefit to others. So what does it mean to be a true friend to ourselves? A friend that is really trustworthy. If you ponder this for a few moments, what qualities stand out? Perhaps reflecting on your dearest friendship will help you with this. Some qualities that come to my mind are, first of all, presence. My true friend is receptive and sincerely interested in what I'm experiencing and listens to me without judgment. She's kind and warm and affectionate and accepting of whatever state I'm in. She's compassionate when I'm in pain, and she's reliable, showing up when I need her. She believes in me, respects me, and is patient, encouraging, and wise. And she also challenges my reactions when they're off base. And she has a sense of humor that helps me lighten up when I take myself too seriously. Perhaps other qualities come to your mind as you muse on this. But wouldn't it be truly wonderful to be this kind of trustworthy friend to yourself? Knowing that you can actually rely on yourself through thick and thin? That no matter what, you don't turn against yourself or reject or abandon yourself. Instead, you remain loving, patient, encouraging, and accepting. So tonight I'd like to explore what it means to stay on our own side and build trust in ourselves. I'd like to consider what gets in the way and what practices help us cultivate a stable and abiding relationship with ourselves. And I think this starts with remembering the basic view underlying mindfulness, which is that human beings are fundamentally good. We really have everything that we need to live peacefully with ourselves and with each other. And our most basic qualities are positive: openness, warmth, intelligence, kindness. And Buddha's teachings say our true nature, our egoless self, is wise and stable, spacious, kind, loving, compassionate. And this basic goodness that we all have is our essential life force, universal energy. And it's often described as luminous, as light. It's not burdened by the concept of a me. Our awakened mind, or our true nature, is always here. But we lose access to it because our minds become conditioned. The messages that we get growing up from the people around us and the circumstances of our lives, including our gender, race, class, religion, ethnicity, all create habits of perceptions and beliefs that distort our experience of reality and our sense of ourself. Our minds become biased. And neuroscientists say that these habits create neural grooves in our brain that truly run us. They're our default operating system. This view, of course, I think is radical. And in these times with so much aggression and hatred spewing around, it might feel like a giant leap of faith to trust that the core of our human consciousness is basically good. Yet I think if we look at what we're naturally drawn to that feels healthy and sustainable, isn't it always towards caring and love, connection, joy, wisdom, compassion, generosity, authenticity? There's a well-known story, perhaps you know it, that illustrates this view. For centuries, a clay statue of a very large Buddha sat in a temple in Thailand. Its origins were unknown, but it became a central part of the temple. And monks would tend to it faithfully, fixing cracks in the clay as it dried in the sun and heat over the years. And one day when a monk was repairing an especially large crack, he peered into it to see how deep the crack ran, and to his surprise, he saw a golden reflection. Curious, he pulled off a piece of the dried clay and discovered there was actually gold underneath the clay. And he pulled off more gold and discovered more gold beneath the clay, and then more gold. And when all the clay was removed, the now famous golden Buddha was fully revealed. So we could say the golden Buddha represents our true nature, our basic goodness that is always here. And the clay that covered it for so long symbolizes the biases and grit and grime of our conditioned mind and our incorrect views of ourself and others. And I love this metaphor because really it reminds us no matter what happens, no matter how many negative habits our minds have, no matter how much doubt or shame we hold about ourselves, or how depressed, or no matter how messed up we believe we are, underneath it all, undisturbed and unaffected by all this clay, our true nature, our wisdom, is always here, shining, waiting to be accessed. And staying with this metaphor, in order to pull off the clay that's covering our gold, we need to recognize the clay as clay, and not the truth of who we actually are. So let's look then at the clay that commonly gets plastered over our inner gold. Because being born female in the patriarchy puts us in a subordinate position to men, we grow up believing we have less power than others. Though we may have lots of exuberance and confidence as girls, as we grow older, the effects of sexism and misogyny insidiously chip away at our sense of self. And to varying degrees, we come to believe that we don't matter as much, we're less intelligent, less valuable, less capable than men. And this diminishment of our power and sense of worth trains us to disconnect from our authentic experience and look to others instead of ourselves for validation that we are enough. Research shows that by the time we reach puberty, our authentic self has gone underground and the habit of othering is solidly in place. We develop deeply ingrained habits of turning against ourselves, a kind of self-aggression, through habits of judging, criticizing, blaming, and shaming, as we try to shape ourselves into being what we think the other wants us to be so we can win their approval. Believing we're flawed, we strive to be perfect, hoping that when we're pleasing enough, we'll be accepted. And then finally, we'll feel safe and secure. Paradoxically, though, bowing and scraping to the god of perfection only keeps us trapped in our fears, anxious and insecure, and blocked from the inner wisdom of our true ultimate security, which is trusting and accepting ourselves, our authentic selves. And so often in my clinical work, I hear women express their anguish over a relationship ending by saying, "I lost myself in the relationship again." And over, I hear women who are completely successful in their external lives, in the privacy of therapy, express self-doubt, persistently afraid that others will be disappointed with them, and rejecting of them. And although this is normal conditioning we all get as females, it's often pathologized as codependency or relationship addiction, and it has high costs for creating intimate and satisfying relationships for us. Habitually dwelling on the other cuts us off from our authentic experience, our truth of the moment. It disconnects us from our bodies, our emotions, our wisdom, our kindness, and our intuition. It trains us to look outside of ourselves for answers rather than within our own inner gold. We become overly responsible for others and ignore our own needs. It creates confusion about our boundaries, making it hard to say no when we need to. And it makes us conflict averse, afraid to say what's really true for us or what we really want. Given this, it's really no surprise that year after year, national mental health statistics show that women experience 2 to 3 times more depression and anxiety than men. Year after year, this has not changed. So being subordinate in the patriarchy is a complete setup for feeling bad about ourselves. And to the extent, then, that we're bound by our conditioned identity, believing we're not enough in certain ways, we simply can't trust ourselves. We get caught up in trying to be how we think we're supposed to be, rather than being authentic. Thus, no matter how often our dearest person, or our parents, or tons of friends may say to us, "Really, you're wonderful just the way you are," when we don't feel that way about ourselves, those loving messages don't get in. Even the Buddha's message that you can search the whole world over and never find anyone more deserving of your own love and affection than yourself can't penetrate these deep neural grooves. So let's look a little bit more deeply at how these habits of turning against ourselves get established and what they are. Driven by the delusion of perfection, the rigid rule of shoulds becomes our inner dogma. Self-criticism, blame, guilt, and shame can become constant undertones, like bad elevator music incessantly playing in our heads. The mighty inner critic can spew relentless rants of disapproving self-judgments, comparisons, conclusions, and corrections. Perhaps you've been hearing some of this as you've been meditating today. I don't know. Maybe you haven't. But if you bring awareness to this soundtrack, you might hear variations of, "Geez, I'm a mess. I can't keep my attention on my breath for more than 2 seconds. Everybody else here seems so serene and calm. Why am I so jittery? I should be calm and relaxed right now. What's the matter with me?" A client of mine, sick of feeling so bad about herself, wanted to get to the bottom of her ever-present chronic anxiety through mindfulness in a psychotherapy session. And this woman is one of the most thoughtful, caring, creative, and brilliant people I know. She suffered from deep-seated anxiety for years and has tried a vast array of therapies to heal from this. So after guiding her into a more inner receptive state, I asked her to deliberately bring to mind situations where the anxiety becomes intense, to stoke it up until she could actually feel it in her body. When she became aware of it, I asked her to describe both the stories, and the precise sensations. And once she was connected with that, then I guided her into a deeper inquiry into the causes. After a bit, she began remembering childhood experiences with her mother that provoked the feeling. And when she asked herself, "What is this anxiety really about? Or what's at the root of this suffering?" what came to her was a startling realization that my mind critically judges absolutely everything I think, feel, say, and do, she said. After every thought, feeling, and action I hear in my mind, she's saying, "You shouldn't think that. You shouldn't feel that. You shouldn't do that. That's wrong." And then she said, "No wonder I think there's something wrong with me. I'm always telling myself there is." Right? She realized the habit of constant criticism and judgment that she's wrong provokes this pervasive anxiety that she feels. witnessing this, I felt so appreciative of her really important insight, but also so very, very sad at the power of our minds to create such suffering for us. It's amazing. Besides searing self-criticism and impatience, born from beliefs about how we should be, we turn against ourselves by shooting painful second arrows, like feeling that ache in your neck, or a twinge in your shoulder, or an odd and unpleasant sensation in your belly. The conditioned mind so quickly spins a catastrophic story about this pain, why it's there, and what will happen to me. What if it gets worse, and I can't stand it? What if it's really serious? What if it's cancer? What if? What if? Our mind goes off in tons of stories. Or with painful emotions, the judging mind can sweep in with jabs like, what am I going to get over being so depressed and anxious? I'm really just so sick of always feeling this way. Why don't I just snap out of it right now, because nobody else really wants to be around somebody so uptight and miserable. So ouch, we scornfully reject ourselves. We also turn against ourselves through habits of distraction, or as Pema Chodron calls them, exit strategies. When our experience is painful, we tend to bolt when it's too uncomfortable. We want to escape and find relief. I've heard Pema lovingly say many, many times, as human beings, we should never underestimate our preference for the pleasant. Right? It's so true. And because we don't like the unpleasant, the conditioned mind lures us into thinking that finding something in the refrigerator, yum, or checking our phone, or having a glass of wine will be just the right comforting thing we need right now to get away from this feeling. But have you noticed that relief, that kind of relief, is really short-lived? So how can we learn to stay on our own side so we can be that wise, reliable, encouraging friend to ourselves? How can we stay on our own side when the going gets rough and find our stability and our wisdom? Well, the first step to healing is always awareness, presence. We can't heal what we can't feel. And since our true nature, who we really are, is calm and stable and spacious and loving and wise, it's a safe bet that whenever we aren't feeling that way, we're hooked into some kind of conditioned pattern. So whenever we wake up to feeling some kind of discomfort, right in that moment we have the possibility of finding freedom. And it's helpful if we can spark some gladness when we spot this. As the wonderful mindfulness teacher Tara Brach says, whenever we notice that we're upset, it's actually good news. It's good news because there's an opportunity for healing. And holding a wise view is essential too. Since we had no choice in learning these conditioned habits, it's not correct to blame ourselves when we're pulled into them. Next, we bear witness to our experience by turning towards it with lots of curiosity. We encourage ourselves to open to our authentic experience just as it is. We can ask the practice question, what is this? What's happening right now? And this prompts us to engage in a mindful inquiry. So we can ask ourselves, well, what exactly is going on in my mind? What am I literally thinking? What's the story? What am I remembering or telling myself? What movie is my mind making? The mind's stories are so powerful, and yet they're all made up. And they may not be at all accurate, let alone helpful. Many of them are rooted in our conditioned and incorrect beliefs. We know that our minds create a lot of fake news. You know? But by discovering the narrative, we can discern what's true and encourage ourselves to let go of what isn't. Then we can continue the inquiry by asking, what am I feeling with this story, with this movie in my mind? What sensation is it creating in my body? We feel emotions as sensations in our bodies. They're the body's reaction to the mind's story. So we encourage ourselves to open to these sensations with lots of curiosity, precision, and kindness, accepting them just as they are. Then rather than resisting, judging, and struggling to change what we're experiencing, we encourage ourselves to totally accept it even though it's unpleasant. So we continue bearing witness with kindness and curiosity. Perhaps you feel butterflies of anxiety in your stomach, or heavy sadness in your chest, or the hot fire of anger in your belly, or the warm pressure of tears behind your eyes. We open to it all just as it is and cradle the sensations with lots of spaciousness and lots of kindness. As Joseph Goldstein, considered one of the best teachers of this practice, suggests, whenever we're experiencing something difficult, we could say to ourselves, whatever it is, it's okay, just let me feel it. Whatever it is, it's okay, just let me feel it. This naturally helps us relax with it, because we're inviting ourselves to simply let it be. And by letting it be, we're creating the inner spaciousness needed to remain stable with the discomfort. And since everything is in the process of change, and we aren't making it more solid by resisting, the feeling can naturally shift on its own. By letting it be, letting go happens organically, without effort. Not identifying with our experience is also key to staying on our own side. The conditioned mind takes everything we experience personally. We give it meaning about ourself, moi. And this keeps us locked into the story and carried off in the narrative, the mind spinning more thoughts about what did or could or should happen to me. Instead, we can disidentify from what we're experiencing by softly noting what's here. For example, instead of noting, I'm so hurt and angry. It's far more effective to say, here's feeling hurt and anger. Dropping that personal pronoun, that I, that I'm, that me, instantly creates more spaciousness to witness and accept what's actually here. I'll never forget a retreat experience where my judging mind seemed like it was on steroids. Every experience I had, whatever I saw, heard and felt, both around me and inside me, was under attack by my inner empress of perfection. I had rigid opinions about everything. I wasn't sitting up straight enough. It was too hot or too cold in the meditation hall. I had a disapproving or approving comment about everything my eye landed on. The food was too spicy or not spicy enough. The woman sitting next to me was breathing too loudly. Right? Happens. And on and on my judging mind went. I was aware of all these judgments, but I second, third, and fourth arrowed myself by judging myself for judging, then judging myself for judging, myself for judging. Right? You get the picture. Yeah. I was coming to conclusions about myself and everything I noticed, and I was stuck in the throes of my judging mind, trapped, really, in a self-made hell. Then in the check-in group, the first woman who spoke began describing how she'd been watching the antics of her judging mind with great delight, amused by all of its silly opinions and views. She actually laughed and chuckled as she described her experience. She seemed to be sincerely entertained by it. This was stunning to me. And then I suddenly realized that I'd been taking the reactions of my judging mind totally seriously because I was completely identifying with them. I was taking the judging mind to be me instead of simply observing the conditioned pattern. No big deal. Instead, I was resisting it, wanting my experience to be different than it was. I was attached to wanting to be open and non-judging of everything. Perfect, in other words. I was forgetting that the point of practice is not to become perfect or to have only perfect experiences, but actually to perfect our ability to love. The point is to learn to be loving towards ourselves no matter what we're experiencing. And this includes loving the judging mind when it's on a rampage. Of course, all along the way, as we open to what's difficult, bearing witness to the anger, fear, self-doubt, physical pain, the judging, we practice relating to it with as much kindness and tenderness and compassion as we can muster. And as we accept our experience, refraining from second arrowing ourselves, refraining from identifying with it, and refraining from coming to conclusions about ourselves, we understand that there's nothing wrong with us because we're experiencing this. They are simply the conditions that exist right now. Yet because this mind state is uncomfortable and painful, and we are the only one who knows truly how painful it is, it's essential to open our hearts to ourselves when this is happening. We can offer heartfelt sympathy to ourselves because we're suffering. We can say to ourselves, I'm so sorry this is happening for me right now. We can practice being a kind and loving mother to ourselves. And doing this helps us stay with a difficult feeling, with a difficult experience. Because it's by staying with it that we sustain our attention with it. And we can experience, by doing this, the alchemy of mindfulness. As we turn towards what's difficult with mindful inquiry, accepting and opening to it with lots of curiosity, not taking it personally, letting it be, giving it space, and offering kindness, we witness the reality of impermanence. At some moment, the painful sensation morphs and recedes, the emotion dissolves, and then quite suddenly we find ourselves feeling lighter, brighter, with more ease. And by staying steady, we may learn more about what's at the root of this particular feeling and pattern, and discover what we really need from ourselves. Further, by witnessing how our experience shifted and changed by relating to it in this way, we build confidence in our ability to handle what's hard. So trust in ourselves deepens through this process. Learning to be a reliable friend to ourselves also requires patience. That we will be pulled into the habits of our conditioning over and over again is, of course, a given. This is not a problem, ever. Those neural grooves in our brains are very deep. Yet neuroscience tells us that our brains are very responsive to experience. They have what's called neuroplasticity, which means that whatever we practice grows stronger in the brain. This is exceedingly encouraging, I think. So in so many ways, mindfulness is simply the willingness to come back to the present moment and begin again. And since patience can only be cultivated in the midst of impatience, we're growing our patience with ourselves. So when impatience arises, you're sick of always reacting the same old sucky way, at whatever moment you wake up to this and realize you've turned against yourself, yay! You can choose to begin again. You're once more back on your own side with access to your wisdom and your true nature. I've had some great practice opportunities with all of this that I'm talking about through promoting my book, the book that I published last year. Having never published a book before, I naively thought that after it was published, that would be it. But it turns out, if you want people to read your book, you have to go and talk about it. In being an introvert, often accompanied by shyness, this has at times felt like I was turning myself inside out. And though it took me a while to recognize it, every time I began preparing to give a talk about the book, I encountered fear. And as the date for the talk would get closer, I'd feel a growing, gnawing anxiety. And then when the talk would just be a few days away, I'd wake up in the morning with a feeling of dread. This was very unpleasant. I did not like it at all. And the first few times this happened, I viewed it as simply the old shyness stuff and the fact that doing this was unfamiliar to me. And feeling so shaky, I'd also shoot myself with secondary judgments like, geez, Mir, you're telling women you can develop unshakable confidence through mindfulness and look at you, right? You're not embodying this at all. You're just being a weenie and shrinking and contracting. But then what would happen at the last minute, I'd find some wise and kind way to companion myself, and the fear would shift into excitement and joy when I actually gave the talk, and I felt really happy about it. But since this painful pattern was arising each time, I finally decided to bring it into a sit to see if I could learn more about it. Perhaps there was something deeper going on for me. So holding the practice question, what is this? I open to the feeling of dread in my body, in my mind stories, the narrative. I realized that I had been imagining the audience, as I was giving the talk, that the audience would be looking back at me with blank faces, as if they were hesitant, holding back, waiting to be convinced or inspired by me. I realized I felt I needed to convince them that what I was saying was worthwhile. I had to prove myself to them and win their approval. And if they didn't like what I was saying, yikes. So as I sat with this story and the sensation of dread, I suddenly realized that this triggered a very old fearful belief rooted in my childhood, which was that whatever I have to say is not worthy of anyone's attention. And it was this that actually provoked the desire to shrink and hide from view. So no wonder I felt dread. I was bumping into a very old version of I'm not enough. So holding all this spaciously, bearing witness to it with kindness and acceptance, now understanding its roots, I asked myself what I truly needed. What would help me stay on my own side with this? What would be a wise and kind way to respond to myself as I'm doing this? What came to me was to be very tender and kind, knowing that this touches a deeply conditioned fear, and to remember that I am enough just as I am in this moment. I realize I don't have to prove myself to the audience, nor do I need their approval. I'm simply offering what I've been learning about women's conditioning and mindfulness that I feel matters. My job is not to convince them, but simply to speak what's true for me. After understanding this, I'm now a lot more relaxed as I prepare and give these talks. It's not that dread or fear never arises again, but when they do, their intensity is way dialed down, and I understand what it's about. And I have confidence that I can stay steady with myself, give the feelings room to be here when they arise, remember how I want to relate to myself, and witness their temporary nature. So learning to mindfully connect with and stay with our authentic experience, whatever it is, through thick and thin, is the essential practice for deepening trust in ourselves. It's knowing and accepting, without judgment or rejection, the mind-body state that we're experiencing right now. This is our truth of the moment, the facts of our actual experience. Of course, practicing this cultivates radical acceptance and radical bravery, spiritual warriorship, the courage to be open and vulnerable to what's happening instead of abandoning or turning against ourselves when we don't like what we're experiencing. Feeling fear, sadness, shame, anger, guilt, disappointment, despair, or grief, this all makes us feel vulnerable and shaky and unprotected, and that feeling usually frightens us. So we need courage to stay steady and open to those feelings. Yet through the willingness to bear witness and stay with the discomfort, we grow tolerance for it, and we see how it's all impermanent. We learn that we can handle whatever arises. We develop faith and confidence in ourselves and deepen our friendship with ourselves in the process. By accepting our authentic self, we become the primary source of our power. We no longer need to defend or protect ourselves from other people's opinions or judgments because we no longer depend on their approval. Further, through accepting ourselves as we are, perfectly imperfect, our ability to accept others as they are, also imperfect, grows. We become more understanding and a better friend to all. So each time we're aware of turning against ourselves, and out of kindness and love we choose to come back and stay with our authentic experience, we are cultivating freedom from our mind's conditioned habits, from our internalized sexism, from the habits of othering, and giving our power away. This is how we return authority for ourselves to ourselves. We are becoming, as the Buddha advised, a lamp unto ourselves. So let's become our own bright light and discover how truly powerful we are. The whole world will benefit. Let's just take a moment to find ourselves. practice for a moment.